中国国家领导人习近平准备在今年秋天召开的中共20大上获得第三个任期，可是清零政策给经济和民生带来的重大打击，还有俄罗斯入侵乌克兰，加深了美中之间的分歧，这些都给习近平带来严峻的挑战。那习近平如何巩固他的核心地位？作为一个专制领导人，他有什么样的心理特质？他的意图和政治抱负又会把中国带向何方？今天我们邀请乔治·布什美中关系基金会高级研究员肯尼斯·德克莱瓦来分析和点评。德克莱瓦先生曾经是美国政府高级医生和外交官，多年来为美国政策和国家安全机构提供外国领导人的能力和心理分析。Dr. Dekliba, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much for hosting me again. It's a pleasure and an honor to be on Voice of America China.
Thank you. So first, what kind of man is Xi Jinping?
I think he's a remarkable leader, and I'm going to borrow the words from the late Singaporean leader Lee Kuan Yew, who called him a remarkable person and a person with remarkable human qualities, and he called him a Nelson Mandela type of figure. And I think that's very striking. And the other high-level leaders who have met with President Xi, such as former Australian Prime Minister and Foreign Minister Kevin Rudd, former U.S. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, and people who I've talked to personally, diplomats and businessmen who've met with Xi, would echo similar statements that he's a highly intelligent, remarkable politician. And I find him to be a fascinating leader to study. And I might add, I agree with the cover of The Economist from 2017 that President Xi is probably the most powerful or second most powerful man in the world today.
But there are other people say Xi Jinping is another strongman leader following former Chinese leader Mao Zedong's path. What do you think about that?
I think parts of that are true in the sense that Xi is a very strong and authoritarian leader who has centralized power over the last decade. So I certainly think he falls into that category. I think he's shown political ruthlessness when he needed to climb his way up the complex internal politics of the CCP, and particularly during the anti-corruption campaign, where he's taken down very powerful figures that could threaten his rule, the so-called tigers. So I think the ruthlessness is there, and we've seen that in other policies, such as the crackdown in Hong Kong and the treatment of the Uyghurs over the last decade, which two U.S. Secretaries of State, including Tony Blinken and Michael Pompeo, have called genocide.
Let's go back to the zero COVID policy. A lot of critics say this policy caused more humanitarian disasters. The damage is more serious than the pandemic itself. What is your response?
Again, I've thought about this carefully, and I think there are two points to it. One is that prior to the 20th CCP Congress, she didn't want to shift policy because that could be seen as retrogressive and possibly weakening his authority. It's probably difficult for him to admit that policy was wrong. But I think she has shown an ability to absorb economic costs of that policy while waiting for the pandemic to pass or to evolve in a way where it's less destructive in order to achieve his goals. And again, I think a 2% death rate in a healthcare system in China, which could not absorb the number of infections and the fact that the population is not fully vaccinated, certainly not with Western level vaccines. And even with Western level vaccines such as Pfizer and Moderna, their breakthrough infections are possible. I think there's a risk of chaos there that she fears, for good historic reasons, that he's not willing to take on. So he's stuck to a very conservative, strict policy as a result.
So over the past decades, she has expanded the meaning of national security in China. He strengthened an already pervasive security system, purged a lot of its enemies. Recently, the Ministry of State Security offered rewards of up to $15,000 for citizens who report information on security crimes. What does that say about Xi Jinping's state of mind? Is he paranoid, insecure, or ruthless?
I think it shows his ruthlessness. I think he's allied himself with the power ministries in China, not only with the PLA, where he served as an aide to a PLA general during one of his first political assignments in the late 70s for several years. But I also think his association with other power ministries within the core of the party organizational structure and the propaganda structures, and I think the last bastion that he's tackled have been the security ministries, where he's now enhanced his power over the last several years and weeded out for corruption charges other potential figures who could be a threat to him. I think he's, as a politician, realizes that he can't have complete control moving forward with his agenda, if you will, in his third term without control of the security ministries, including the MSS.
So how do you understand the relationship between Xi Jinping, Russian leader Putin, and the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un? What do these dictators have in common psychologically?
First of all, I wouldn't use the word dictator for Xi or Putin. I think they're authoritarian, but they have power centers. In Russia, the Siloviki, the power ministries, and Xi has, they're beholden to the power ministries in Putin's case. And in Xi's case, he's beholden to the CCP, which is the ultimate power ministry. So I think they're very authoritarian leaders. But getting back to what do President Xi and President Putin have in common? Certainly the authoritarianism. And I think their relationship, while close, they've met over three dozen times in the last decade. And in the Winter Olympics, after the Winter Olympics proclaimed a partnership with no limits, I think analysts have overvalued that to some extent. And here's why I think that, and what I'll share with your listeners. One is China and Russian history, they've not always been kind to both countries. In my lifetime, it's worth remembering they almost went to nuclear war in 1969. And there have been, certainly there's been chatter over the last several years on Chinese social media websites saying that if we're going to take Hong Kong back and Taiwan back, what about the Russian Far East, which was Chinese territory before the 19th century, including Vladivostok? So I think that relationship is, one has to be careful not to overvalue it. Also, I think Putin is a disruptor, very clearly an international post-World War II, certainly post-1991, post-Cold War rules-based order. She's not a disruptor in the same way. I think he wants a seat at the table in the order, but with more control and more influence for a rising China. So I think they're different in that regard. The other thing to note is that in spite of the closeness of the relationship and the words that have been come out of Chinese media and the foreign ministry, vis-a-vis support for Putin in the Ukraine war, China has not sent any weapons to Russia, nor has there been any foreign direct investment by China into Russia since the beginning of the war. So that speaks volumes to me. Now, getting back to Chairman Kim Jong-un, the leader of North Korea, I think that relationship certainly since 2017, 2018, when they met several times during 2018 and 2019, has been warmer, and I think there's more tolerance by President Xi of Chairman Kim's provocative actions and less pushback, if you will. But that being said, I don't think that's a close relationship in the way that his relationship and alliance is with Russia. I think it's a necessary relationship because President Xi wants a stable North Korea for fear a collapsing North Korea would be devastating for China politically and economically. The flow of millions of refugees in that and the chaos of a nuclear weapon state collapsing is intolerable.
You mentioned Xi Jinping has not offered support to Russia, I mean, weapons to Russia or Ukraine. So what do you think his neutral position?
I think when push comes to shove, Chinese diplomats have echoed fairly consistently when you sort out the wheat and the chaff, if you will, from the more bombastic wolf warrior type statements, you know, including blaming the U.S. for starting the war. I think they know that's nonsense, but they've been pretty consistent in calling for diplomacy to resolve the war and also pretty consistent against the use of sanctions against Russia. And what I find most striking in recent weeks was Ukrainian President Zelensky's open call to President Xi to help mediate and help negotiate an end to the war. I find that striking. That's like a Christmas present for Xi because it shows his value as a leader and as a, if you will, a responsible, more like a responsible stakeholder, to borrow Robert Zoellick's famous 2005 term, than as a disruptor. The fact that President Zelensky would openly call on Xi to use his influence with President Putin to help mediate an end to this tragic, horrible war in the Ukraine.
Some Western observers tend to deem Xi to be of an average intelligence. Do they underestimate Xi?
Absolutely. Nothing could be farther from the truth than such a statement. First of all, if you just look at what that term means, average intelligence implies that when you have IQ testing, that you're a high school graduate, that you have the intellect of a normal high school graduate. Most leaders that have been studied, now granted, in the United States by psychologists that have retroactively looked at writings and speeches and decisions, have found that leaders, political leaders at this level, tend to have very high full-scale IQs, ranging from 120 to, in some cases, as high as 160. The cutoff for genius level is 140 and up. I would argue that President Xi is a person of very, very high intelligence based on the speeches, the writings, the way we see his intellect and his political decision making. And I think there's other aspects of intelligence that those tests don't measure, where Xi would score very high, not only according to me, but former Prime Minister Kevin Rudd. His political intelligence, people would say, is Prime Minister Rudd has said that it's like watching a master class in political control and how to take power. And I think President Xi, based on what I know from people who've met with him and talked to him, spent a whole day with him. These are U.S. Diplomats and business people who've met with President Xi over the last two decades, have all stated he's very polite, he's very calm, and he's a good listener. And I think while Xi has shown a lot of boldness and aggressiveness, if you will, in pushing the great dream forward, if you look at the militarization of the South China Sea, the cyber attacks, the projection of the Belt and Road Initiative, one of his signature policies, and certainly we'll talk about Taiwan, what's gone on recently, I think he's shown aggressiveness, but he does it not in an impulsive way, but in a thoughtful and cautious way. And he does it because so far everything he's done, he's gotten away with. There's been very little pushback from the United States in terms of things that he's done in this regard.
So if he becomes a president of life, what path would he take China on?
This is the, as we would say in the US, the $64,000 question or the X factor. I don't know. And I would encourage your listeners to read Chris Johnson's latest monograph published this past week, looking at this very same question. Chris Johnson is a former senior analyst who spent decades studying China for the CIA, and now he works for CSIS, a US-based think tank. So I think we don't know. And as I've written, I think the big question is she a rigid ideologue who can't show flexibility and adapt to changes? Or is he more flexible or a mixture of both? From my understanding of his leadership psychology, he's a mixture of both. While he's been rigid at times, he's flexible and cautious when he needs to be. And this is shown in his speeches and writings, including in a very now famous interview, but at the time very an unknown interview that he gave to an obscure Chinese newspaper in 2000.
You just mentioned your article titled "She's Paradox, Flexible, Ideological, or Both." In that article, you wrote that House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's recent highly provocative trip to Taiwan has placed China, Taiwan, and America front and center at the most dangerous flashing point in international relations. So Taiwan reunification is the key piece of Xi Jinping's great Chinese dream and justify his move to abandon term limits. How likely is she to use military force against Taiwan?
I think at some point, if he needed to, and if Taiwan crossed certain red lines, such as the Declaration of Independence, he would be forced to, given his own pronouncements and the domestic politics and tides of nationalism which he has courted in the Great China Dream. I think that's a genie that he let out of the bottle and can't easily put back in it. We saw examples of that where bloggers on Chinese social media were angry that the PLA didn't shoot down Nancy Pelosi's plane. She would never do something that stupid, but it shows the sentiment that he has to pay attention to, that he's unleashed in the Great Chinese Dream of rejuvenation. Like all great dreams, make America great again, other types of countries' dreams, always has a nationalist component to it. And she has to be careful with that. I think the exercises were clearly have been rehearsed and they've had war gaming scenarios and plans. I'm not a military expert, but they didn't just pull this together in 48 hours when Speaker Pelosi's plane landed. But they dusted off a playbook that's been well rehearsed and were careful to do things after she had left. There were no live fire exercises while she was on the island in Taipei. They did everything after she'd left. What I found striking and of concern is that there's, for all of the talk of the United States about shoring up alliances such as AUKUS, the Quad, nothing happened. I wonder if President Xi and the Chinese leadership and the PLA expected some response from the U.S. military, some sort of counter response. And the sad answer is nothing happened. They were able to do this with incredible freedom within 48 hours. You could argue that she's playing Go and we're struggling to play checkers, to borrow a famous Chinese game analogy. And the other thing is, not all of our allies were critical. South Korea was relatively silent about this. So I think the Chinese are going to take all this in very carefully. But I don't think she will act impulsively. I think what they are more likely to do is to squeeze the oxygen out of the room, if you will, by using cyber, asymmetric, and gray zone tactics. Further blockades are possible. diplomatic pressures on countries that have relations with Taiwan, companies that do business with Taiwan. They could boycott those companies. There's a lot of ways they can squeeze Taiwan. And I think we can expect increased pressure in that space over the next several years.
Then how will she handle the U.S.-China relations, since there's not sufficient response or actions from the Western world?
My concern is that President Xi is relying heavily on very hawkish advisors, and that there's a large, because of his control and purges and in the next party Congress, he's likely to further stack the Politburo Standing Committee with people that think alike. There's a real risk of groupthink and of hardline groupthink that he has to be careful, that they could push him to take an action vis-a-vis Taiwan that would be very highly risky for China, not only politically and economically and militarily, but in terms of its reputation as a responsible growing superpower that could harm China. And I think Xi knows that intuitively from what I've read. He's been more careful in his statements. He did say to President Biden in their video call 2 weeks ago that with Taiwan, I'm paraphrasing, one should be careful and not play with fire. But by embracing the nationalist element and the hardline elements in the PLA, even co-opting them under his control, President Xi is playing with fire as well, and he has to be careful.
My last question, what is Xi's biggest blind spot?
I think his biggest blind spot is his underestimation of America. That's a huge blind spot. And it's easy for analysts and readers and listeners to understand that, because America right now is very politically divided. It's weakened economically. It's still the strongest power in the world, but it's struggling with inflation, with a possible recession, with a very divided country, very highly politicized, very fragmented. And it's easy to buy into the narrative that President Xi has articulated in his leading theorists, such as Yuan Peng, the head of the CICIR, a think tank affiliated with the MSS, has written last year, the East is rising and the West is in decline. I'm old enough to have heard this kind of thinking about America for decades. I was a teenager after the Vietnam War. This thinking was prevalent then. There were other times when this thinking in later years was prevalent, but one has to be careful. America is a remarkably resilient country with its own history and its own exceptionalism, if you will. And President Xi and the Chinese leadership should never underestimate America's ability to bounce back and to counter a rising and aggressive China. They would be wise to look to the words of Admiral Yamamoto, who told the Japanese leadership at the beginning of World War II, "I'm a patriot. I will support what you do in the bombing of Pearl Harbor." But he also told Prime Minister Hideki Tojo and the Emperor, "This is a war that we can't win." And he knew this from his studies at Harvard for several years. So even though Xi has not lived in America, he's surrounded by many people who have studied in America and know America well, including Liu He, one of his top ministers on the standing Politburo, former foreign minister and current state counselor Yang Jiechi, and others. So I think he has to be careful in getting the right analysis about what America's future looks like. In that sense, my guess is Xi will be more patient and careful, and will wait and see what happens to America in 2024 when we have our next presidential election, because that will really determine the course of politics in America for the next 4 to 8 years.
Thank you so much, Dr. Dekaliva, for helping us understand Xi Jinping as a man and as a leader. Thank you.
Thank you very much for hosting me. Appreciate it.
非常感谢乔治·布什美中关系基金会高级研究员肯尼斯·德克莱瓦先生的分析和点评。来宾发表的都是个人意见，并不一定代表美国之音。